Pod Law Series 7, Episode 1. It's the catch-up show. We are joined, as ever, by Kirsten Bezick, of course, is with us. Hello.
Hello.
And we're also joined... it's nice to be back, isn't it? You have news as well for our lovely listeners.
I've got lots of news. More shows about news. Did you want personal news?
Well, I just wondered whether they might want to know why we're not all in North Pod Towers together.
Oh, it's just a little bit busy.
Having what do they call it now?
Oh, a baby.
That's the fella. and he's a lovely little fella too.
He is. He's very cute.
And we've also got ever present Jonathan
Another
Holt. Hello, hello.
Thank you. Hello. It's good to be back.
Now, you occasionally may hear us making references during this show to you being able to see things. That was because very temporarily, this is going to be available on YouTube. Probably not to by the time you actually get to listen to this. Fortunately, we're just experimenting. But there you go. All right. So, Kirsten, what have we got to start us off with? Series 7.
Well, it's all about the news, really. It's all about where we're up to or what's happened since we last left you, listeners. We've got a cost case which should worry everybody. We've got, what else have we got? We've got rights of jewellery-wearing employees, which Jonathan, I think, is going to talk us through.
Yes.
We've also got rights of consumers with a case about moving home. And whether you can just change your mind at the last minute. Possibly going to get to talk about Section 5 public order because they're looking at reforming it, ladies and gentlemen.
Indeed they are.
Indeed. And that's pretty much it. There might be a couple of extra bits. There have been other things happening whilst we've been away. But you know what we're like for talking, so shall we see where we get to?
That's indeed. Well, let's start with this cost case then. And I suppose the question really arising out of it is, when is a party not a party?
When it's us.
That's pretty accurate, yeah. Fair enough.
This is the case. It's a local case for us, actually. This is a case. It's a judicial review matter. It's the CPS against Bolton Crown Court. And the general counsel of the bar was acting as an intervener because of its import to anybody. It's not just important to barristers because it would affect solicitors as well, I would say.
Mm-hmm. It does, I think, expressly, yeah.
Yeah. Right. This is a case of Bolton Crown Court where the CPS had obviously done something that they weren't supposed to do. Mm. And counsel in the case asked for a wasted costs order against the CPS, and it was granted.
So if Hurrah.
You can possibly imagine such a thing, dear listeners, the CPS had done something, hadn't done something they were supposed to, or had done something they weren't supposed to, and we know that never happens.
No, quite.
No. So in this case, as I say, they were awarded wasted costs, and the CPS appealed that decision, and they appealed it on the basis that council are not a party to the proceedings.
It's a strange
Mr. Knight will tell you what they said, I think.
Well, in short, it was very simply that. It was the fact that for a wasted costs application, you must be a party to the proceedings. So in those circumstances, that will include the Crown Prosecution Service, as they are the R in R against mm-hmm. somebody or other, and the somebody or other who is the name that follows the R and the V in the name of a case. So in other words, a defendant.
It is right. The legislation does say a party to proceedings may make an application for wasted costs.
Absolutely. And it's interesting as well, because there will have been various cases over the years where orders have been made in favour of maybe counsel or solicitors in those cases. When that judgment came out, in fact, two of our number were in the middle of asking for costs in a case where the Crown Prosecution Service had...
In fact, we'd actually asked for it. We were waiting for the judgment.
We were, and then Curse said, Crown Court Judge, he went and blimmin' read it, didn't he? And said, oh, hang on a moment. It looks like I don't have to make my mind up at all.
Being asked to make this decision, but before I've actually made it.
Yeah.
This has come in, and now I don't have to make the decision, so I'm not going to.
Now, of course, you may remember, listeners and indeed viewers now, a long time ago, I can't even remember which series it was now, the episode called How to Stay Out of the Naughty Court. Series 2, thank you very much.
Series 2, episode 1.
Oh, very good. Now, in that episode, His Honour Judge Lakin, the presiding judge at Minchell Street Crown Court in Manchester, set out fairly robustly that case management was about to get a bit of an overhaul. And, of course, one of the things he said about that, when pushed about whether the sanctions would be imposed heavily against the defence and CPS, was that they would. And, of course, part of that was the possibility of cost sanctions against the Crown Prosecution Service where they had failed to comply with orders and so on.
Now, and he positively encouraged applications.
He did, absolutely. Now, of course, the difficulty is with this judgment that if you've got a legally aided or a legal aided defendant, there may be some possibility in terms of costs in his favour, given the situation with funding for Crown Court legal aid work now. But in reality, the people who would have been making those applications and who would have been financially inconvenienced in those cases were the barristers attending court or the HCAs attending court. And, of course, there is now no sanction.
No. As I said, because as you say, if they're privately funded, it's not a problem because you would charge your client.
Yes.
And your client then makes the application in order that he doesn't have to pay you.
Yeah, true enough, yeah.
But if he's legally aided, that just doesn't happen because the party is never paying you. He's never going to be out of pocket. How can you charge him?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, the court in deciding this is the, I think it was the High Court, Admin Court, possibly. Yeah. I think it was, wasn't the Court of Appeal.
I think that's right. It wasn't the Court of Appeal. It was a judicial review.
Yes, that's right. Now, in deciding that, you'll notice, and as Kirsten said earlier on, the General Counsel of the Bar was an intervener in this case. And that's because, in real terms, everyone is aware of the fact that there is a problem here and professionals shouldn't be left out of pocket any more than anyone else because of the shortfallings of a party who is in a advantageous position. They can, of course, CPS can, of course, make applications for wasted costs against defence counsel. Fairly rare, but it can happen. So here, the High Court simply said that they had to obviously impose and apply the law as it was, but they were clearly not happy about having to do so. And they either invited or it was suggested, mutually agreed, that there would be something of a working group set up by the General Counsel of the Bar, and I think the Law Society as well, from recollection, into how this can now be changed. And the Ministry of Justice is supposed to be taking part in that exercise as well. Of course, we have yet to hear what the outcome is going to be.
It's 15 years, we can just hope.
That seems to be the position. We just sort of keep our fingers crossed and know that, we're probably not going to make any money in those situations. So
it's
for every barrister and
priority, isn't it, for Theresa to get the legislation sorted? You can see that that's going to be, top of her agenda.
I would imagine she is desperate for the Crown Prosecution Service to pay out money to cash-strap legal aid defence counsel who aren't getting paid for going to court. Yes, I shouldn't imagine she's slept since then as a result of her concern. Anywho, there you go.
So the upshot, anyway, of this case is that there are no sanctions. There is no stick with which to beat the CPS. They can not disclose things for years, months. They can not comply with orders. They can do anything they like. And short of a judge actually wanting to know who is individually responsible, and of course now certainly in Manchester and most of the Northwest, I don't know about every CPS, there is no case ownership, so there is no individual who is responsible at the CPS. They can just do what they like and get away with it scot-free. It's outrageous, isn't it?
That's pretty much it, yeah. So anyway, there we go. There's a cheery start to Series 7 and
Happy
to the start
New Year.
Of... yeah. You never know. It may all change. It may all change. But for now, lots of barristers feel like this. I'm sorry. I know.
Sorry, he's found a little button to play with. Boys,
I know. Terribly sorry. All right. Okay. Well. Anyway, that's some cheery news. On to some more cheery news.
Yes. This is in some ways more cheery. Jonathan, tell us about what jewellery you can wear at work.
Well, exactly. It's cheery in some respects, but I'd be honest, a lot of this is makes for miserable reading because really, well, I'll explain. There are a total of four appellants in this case, or applicants as they are, because they all applied to the European Court of Human Rights for a decision about whether or not certain decisions that had been made in their lives were compatible with either Article 9 or Article 14. Some of them had both. Of course, Article 9 is the one that says effectively you've got freedom of religion. Article 14 is the one that says you cannot be discriminated against when applying any of the other rights. So there's massive amounts of overlap between the two. The one that we've all heard about is Ms. Awaida. That's the one that's been in the news because it's certainly the most uplifting of all the stories. It's the successful one. This is the story that an applicant who works for British Airways was, she was a Coptic Christian. And from for the first 18 years of her life, she'd lived in Egypt. Wearing her cross visibly seems to have become part of her manifestation of that religion. One of the interesting things about this case is that it's never been challenged by any of the, either the Employment Tribunal or the Employment Appeal Tribunal or at the Court of Appeal or at the House of Lords, as it then was. Mm. It was never challenged whether or not the wearing of the cross externally did actually constitute a manifestation of the religion or not. Or because there has to be a nexus between the act that's pursued and the actual religion itself. Yes. But one thing that seems to have gone completely unchallenged on every level is whether or not wearing a cross visibly is a manifestation of the Christian faith, or in this case, the Coptic Christian faith.
I wonder if that was done deliberately because there are other religions where there are clear manifestations of the faith.
Well, this is it, isn't it? And that's why I find this to be an interesting point. Why is this treated differently? And is that right? Is it, for instance, do we not want to say that when we're dealing with manifestations of the Christian faith, when there are other faiths such as Sikhism, which yes. have such clear manifestations, that the wearing of the turban is obviously
there are seven
to hide.
There are seven signs of being a Sikh that you have to do to one degree or another.
Sure,
this was something considered to some extent in this case because, of course, British Airways staff could already, even at the point when this decision was made, wear turbans and hijabs without any problem. The problem arose here.
Indeed, interestingly, the turban point was that they could wear them in British Airways colours. You could wear a blue turban or a white turban. So clearly, there is an interference there with their manifestations, but not one that actually put them at a disadvantage. Or so we assume. A Sikh may complain.
There's nothing in the Sikh faith that says you have to wear a particular colour of turban, wearing a particular colour.
Indeed.
So it doesn't interfere with your faith. There are other aspects of their religion that might be harder. The dagger, for example.
That probably would be harder on an aeroplane. I probably have to concede that point.
Well, there's nothing to say what size it has to be. So you can have something minute.
I'm learning here. I'm learning. This is not something I was aware of in relation to the Sikh religion. Before we get to the decision, in the first applicant's case, the second applicant, if we just go through them each in turn, the second applicant is a Ms. Chaplin. She's also Christian. It's again about the wearing of a cross on her neck. But she works for the NHS. She works as a nurse. And they had a uniform policy saying that jewellery must be discreet, but specifically that no necklaces should be worn. And the reason why is to prevent risk of injury to patients. And effectively what she said was, well, what's the problem with me wearing it? Well, imagine that you're leaning over an elderly patient. They might grab out for it. And if they grab it, all sorts of things could happen. So she says, okay, I'll wear it on a magnetic clasp so that if it's grabbed by an elderly patient, it just detaches and it doesn't cause any injury. And the hospital said, well, no, because the elderly patient thing is just part of the problem. you've also got things like it could fall into open wounds. It's a source of infection. Just don't wear it. And she said, well, her other suggestion was, well, I've got these name tags that I have to wear around my neck on a lanyard. I'll attach it to that. So if you can justify the lanyard, you can justify the cross. And they said, well, no, you have to take the lanyard off at certain times anyway. So all of those things were automatically dismissed. It was also quite clear that they were at a crossroads. The third applicant is a Ms. Liddell. The third and fourth, first and second are similar. They both involve wearing of necklaces. Third and fourth are similar. They both involve people objecting to same-sex marriages on the basis of their religion. So Ms. Liddell, again, Christian. The Court of Human Rights describes her beliefs as being sincere, that same-sex civil partnerships were contrary to God's law. She was employed by the London Borough of Islington. So the reason why the European Court's interfering in this case is because the state is the employer. So unlike the British Airways case, but like the NHS case. We'll come back to that later on, what that means, the fact that you've got one private company and one public company, and should the European courts be interfering, etc. But what happened here is that she worked for the London Borough of Islington, so she's working for the state, and they've got an actual equality and diversity policy that they've got a name for, and it's called the Dignity for All policy. The long and short of it is they are to treat everybody equally, regardless of age, gender, disability, faith, which, of course, if you're dealing with granting civil partnerships or granting marriages, one might not be surprised to hear that they promote that kind of diversity. The situation progressed to the extent that now, when was this?
Well, I can help with this to a point. So yeah. When Lillian Liddell became the Registrar for Births, Deaths and Marriages, at that point it was pre civil partnership legislation. Yep. So this was 2002, I think. Now, of course, then the legislation changed, and one of the difficulties that rose, and part of her argument was, this isn't what I signed up for.
No, I have great sympathy with that argument.
Save for, this is where the policy that Jonathan's talking about, which did exist in 2002, comes back into play, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, effectively. The policy that I've described was a pre-Civil Partnership Act policy. I think I might have the date for it, for the date of their policy. Yeah, they had it from 1992, so well predates 2004. So the Civil Partnership Act comes into force, it's 2004 Act, but it comes into force in December 2005, and it requires legal registrations of civil partnerships to be available. What Islington decided to do was to say, right, all of our existing registrars are also now going to be civil partnership registrars. Now, Islington didn't have to do that. The legislation that was put in place just required them to make sure that there were enough civil partnership registrars to carry out that function. Some other authorities took a different approach and said, right, if you're a registrar with a sincerely held religious objection, you can opt out. But obviously, it seems that Islington have decided that, given that they've got this diversity for all policy in place, to do that might not be in keeping with their own policy. So they've gone for...
And also they did sort of add to that in that they said that one of the issues how they viewed it anyway, was that because these were civil ceremonies, not civil partnerships, civil ceremonies in registry offices that she was being asked to do in the first place. That's what she did sign up for. That those of themselves were outside, in fact, expressly outside of the remit of religion. God is not secular. In a registry office, absolutely secular. Yeah. Now, for those reasons, so they justified the Borough of Islington effectively, well, really barely even considering whether there was an issue here on religious basis, because as far as they were concerned, the people involved in conducting these ceremonies were, professionally at least, ignoring or putting to one side their religious convictions and beliefs for the purposes of doing their job.
Yeah. I think that probably is a fair summary of what the facts were in Ms. Liddell's case. So your final one, applicant number four, is a Mr. McFarlane. Again, practicing Christian.
Just before we move on from Liddell.
Sure.
It bears consideration that there were two minority judgments in the case of Lillian Liddell. Now, unlike the majority decision, so this was a court of seven judges, unlike the majority decision of the five, which is drafted by officials taking the considerations of each of those five judges together, that's how those are physically written, the judgments of the dissenting minority judges are produced by them themselves. They write them together. The two minority judges in Lillian Liddell's case from Montenegro and Malta did, in their written judgment, come out with quite a staggering and perhaps really rather revealing statement. They said, and this is a quote from the translation. No, the judgment was in English, so this is a quote directly from the judgment. A combination, this is what they found about Lillian Liddell, a combination of backstabbing by her colleagues and the blinkered political correctness of the borough of Islington, which clearly favoured, and then it's in inverted commas, gay rights over fundamental human rights, eventually led to her dismissal. Now, many people reading this judgment have been rather concerned that the minority judges from Montenegro and Malta have created very clearly, and it seems very deliberately, a distinction here between gay rights and human rights, suggesting that perhaps they are not one and the same. Now, those writing in support of the Montenegro and Maltese judges have said, well, actually, I think what they might have meant, although they've accepted, the European Court said, yes, this would never have appeared in an official judgment from a majority judgment. Yeah. What they might have meant is convention rights.
I was going to say, actually, they do have a point, don't they? Because actually, if the Human Rights Act doesn't include a right to sexual orientation at all, as far as I'm aware, actually, they're quite right.
It's
not the best wording.
I'm not sure we can say that, though, because...
Because of Article 8.
Well, Article 14, Article 8, yeah, that's a good point.
Article 8, specifically. The manner in which Article 8 has perhaps been interpreted within certainly the British courts.
Well, I'd go for 14 then, because I'd say, just reading 14, the enjoyment, so 14 doesn't exist on its own. 14 is a right that deals with how you are entitled to enjoy all of your other rights.
Yes.
And your enjoyment of your other rights shall be secured without discrimination on any ground, such as sex, race, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, forgive me for one moment.
You're still entitled to, how would it affect your, I suppose it's whether it would affect your family life, isn't it?
I would certainly struggle to support an argument that you don't have any rights to enjoy your article rights as a gay person.
No, I don't think that's what they're saying. I think what they're saying is that actually your fundamental right is, I suppose, is to be gay. I don't know, but do we actually have that anywhere in the Human Rights Act? I'm not sure we do, which is a bit of a surprise, really, when you stop and think about it.
It's an interesting point that has been raised on the behalf of the minority judgments, whether or not that was intended by them, I'm not sure.
I have to say, the reason I mention it is it does very much seem as if they are purposely making that point. And there is a more than slightly homophobic aspect to that.
Well, it's appalling wording, isn't it? I mean, the wording really does, like, oh, really? We didn't want to say it like that. If that's what you meant, you really should have thought that through.
Did they actually put gay rights in inverted commas?
Oh, yes.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. That might actually make it better, because they may actually mean not actually the rights of homosexuals, but the what is perceived to be.
Oh, it's bad either way.
Again, though, you may wonder. I mean, the rest of that sentence, of course, refers to the borough of the blinkered political correctness of the borough of Islington, which clearly favoured gay rights over fundamental human rights. I think when you take that sentence
it's awful. It's a dreadful sentence.
Yeah, it's pretty damn poor. Yay, Montenegro and Malta, welcome to Europe.
It's really worrying when it's.
Well, all I'll say is this.
Judicial standing so high as well. And it's not as though it is a translation, you know, Malta-lay speak English.
Well, I tell you what, all I'm going to say for that is that given the very high number of Eurovision viewers of the homosexual persuasion, when it comes to next year's competition, the entries of Montenegro and Malta are probably not going to receive very large votes.
You see, they didn't think about this, did they? They just didn't think that through when they were coming out with this.
They didn't think it through.
We don't have stereotypes here, though, do we, Ben?
I think I'm allowed to say things. all right. Sorry, Jonathan, you were going to move on to Darren McFarlane.
Let's do with Mr. McFarlane. So Mr. McFarlane is the last of these four. I always think, imagine if you had your application joined and you took your application very seriously and then you found out you were applicant number four. I think that would be disappointing.
I have been applicant three once before, and it's crushing.
Yeah.
I've always been applicant one, but I've had cases where they're heard together, and therefore mine has been further down the list. So you then become applicant. In effect, you're never at that point. But in effect, you become sort of applicant two or whatever. It's always quite pleasurable when they don't get what they want and you do.
Not in this case, as we'll find out. So Mr. McFarlane, Christian, elder of a big multicultural church in Bristol, and his belief is that the Bible states that homosexual activity is sinful. Now, I think this is important. Well, because that's the one thing that the Bible does seem to say is argued.
It's absolutely clear. Yeah.
And that he should do nothing that which directly endorses such activity. So homosexual activity, I will not endorse it, says Mr. McFarlane. And he works for Relate, which, if you don't know what Relate is, if you're international, Relate is quite a well-known organisation. It's an organisation of counsellors, and the counsellors are members of an association for sexual and relationship therapy.
It used to be called Marriage Guidance, which is probably where the key
probably
comes.
Why it's had to change its name, to be honest. And effectively, what this does is it provides relationship counselling services and also sex therapy, which I didn't know about until I read this judgment. And they have a code of ethics and principles of good practice. And those include some pretty important concepts, you know, really are fundamental things that have been in immigration law, you know, for a long time. So you've got self-determination, the right to self-determination is in their guidance. You've got, this is fantastic. I think this has been tremendously well drafted. Awareness of one's own prejudices. The therapist must be aware of his or her own prejudices and avoid discrimination. It's almost like he's aware of his own prejudices, isn't he? Yeah, but I think that's quite a positive way to draft that, because do we not all have prejudices? And as long as you're aware of them and you manage them and you avoid discriminating on the basis of them, you know, is that what they're saying? Possibly it's a slightly more open way to approach their position. Anyway.
Sorry, I'm laughing because for anybody who can see this, there is a very large looking cat that has appeared over this tonight's show.
Hello, smudgy cat. This is my cat, ladies and gentlemen.
This is the best podcast in the world. This is fantastic.
I know. Sorry if you're listening to the show. Just imagine the most awesome cat ever.
I thought he was standing in the shadow because he was so big against
the wall. He's just extremely tall.
Very regal.
Oh, he is. I was going to change my lower third on the screen so it said Benjamin Knight and Smudge Cat, but I won't. Anyway, do carry on, Jonathan.
Sorry, Jonathan.
That's all right. So Relate also has an equal opportunities policy. I'll skip to the important matters. So initially, Mr. McFarlane, he'd worked from May 2003 until March 2008, which again we're spanning the civil partnership legislation, aren't we?
Yeah.
And I think this is another
factor.
That's
the point, isn't it? You haven't got a leg to stand on if you've applied for a job after.
Well, yes, indeed. 2008. So initially, Mr. McFarlane had concerns about providing counselling services for same-sex couples. But initially, he accepted, after discussing it with his supervisor, that if you were just counselling a homosexual couple, that didn't necessarily endorse their relationship. He was persuaded that that was the case. I'm not entirely sure that's right, to be honest, but nevertheless, he conceded the issue, and he provided counselling services to two lesbian couples without any problem. But then again, no sexual issue, or no purely sexual issues arose. Skip forward a number of years, we go to 2007, and Mr. McFarlane commences Relate's postgraduate diploma in psychosexual therapy. So he's now got qualifications in specifically sort of sexual therapy skills. And there started to form a perception within Relate that Mr. McFarlane was perhaps unwilling to work on sexual issues with homosexual couples. His manager seems to have taken a fairly firm approach to this, saying, look, I can't filter clients out. And this is crucial because, of course, once Relate starts filtering clients, it's like our cab rank rule, isn't it? It starts to become more difficult for same-sex couples to actually get any therapy if Relate is having to start to filter them before they get to the therapist.
Well, absolutely, because one of the issues with, well, one of the things that arose with Relate in some other cases, in fact, has been whether there was a problem in counselling in relation to sexual therapy. Those who were in a relationship but were not married, because, of course, Relate, as part of its charter, deals with simply those in relationships. They don't have to be married. And of course, depending on one's religious persuasion, and I don't know in Mr. McFarlane's case exactly where he stood on that. Of course, if you were his manager, you start to build quite a long list. So you'll deal with lesbians. You'll deal with married or unmarried heterosexual couples, basically disappearing.
What about adulterers?
Well, absolutely, but then all, you know, as you build that picture, you gradually just come down to one issue, which is you don't really like dealing with gay men, do you? Which, you know, you may think that that if that's at the nub of all of this, then really we go back to the original document, and he had to be aware of his own prejudices and not to allow those to interfere. It was there in black and white when he signed up.
Well, effectively, it's gone further and further. There was some further back and forth between him and his employers. There was a conversation that he had with his manager saying, are you going to be okay with this? He seems to have said yes, but then seems to have reneged from it. The conclusion was that he was summarily dismissed for gross misconduct. His manager having concluded that he said he would comply with Relate's policies without actually having any intention of doing so. So that was the basis of it. Right, so let's get to the meat and potatoes, as it were. If I can go to the judgments, if you bear with me for just a moment. Yes, right, so we'll talk about Article 9, just get to the actual judgments themselves. Right, the first applicant. Right, what was concluded, this is where I was going to come back to the issue about the wearing of the symbol at work.
Well, the nice lady from British Airways, she was allowed to wear her cross, wasn't she? Because it doesn't interfere with her job, in effect.
Well, first of all, it is a manifestation of her religious belief. That's gone completely unchallenged. Although she was employed by a private company, let's just deal with this issue now. The question then becomes whether or not her right to freely manifest her religion is sufficiently secured within our legal order, within our legal framework. And the conclusion of this was that when considering the proportionality of the steps that British Airways took, if I can summarise it like this, it was a legitimate aim that the British Airways were pursuing, but it wasn't proportionate in that they didn't strike a fair balance. In terms of the United Kingdom effectively has failed sufficiently to protect the applicant's rights to manifest her religion, primarily because every time she took it to a court in the United Kingdom, she was told the opposite of what you
were. And of interest is the fact that a judge on the panel in the European Court, if he happens to be from the member state which is the subject of the appeal. Of course, his judicial independence takes him beyond his national origin. Yep. In this case, it's very interesting to know that the dissenting judge is against this decision for the stewardess from BA. The two dissenting judges were Icelandic and British. Right. So even in the European court, apparently there was something in the British psyche of the judiciary that simply did not allow for this.
Dear me. Yeah. No, I did not know that. So that's the conclusion there, really. Some comments that they made. A fundamental right is that a healthy democratic society needs to tolerate and sustain pluralism and diversity, but also the value to an individual who's made religion a central tenet of his or her life must be able to communicate that belief to others. And on the other side, you've got the employer's wish to protect their corporate image. Too much weight on a perfectly legitimate aim, but too much weight on it. So, second applicant.
One other thing about that as well was it's worth saying for British Airways' point of view, and I know the court considered this as well in the judgment.
Oh, they changed their policy.
They did, which of course the European court said, well, that demonstrates that the earlier prohibition on these symbols was not of crucial importance.
Yeah,
so,
indeed.
Really,
that goes to your proportionality.
Absolutely. So the whole case for her can be summed up as, you know, you've got a balancing act. On one side is her interest to manifest her religious belief. On the other side is the company wanting to have a certain corporate image. Do the maths between yourselves as to which of those is the more important. And the answer should be self-evident.
It should be. But it, like you say, if it's not, look at who's backed out. Look at who's backed down first. British Airways backed down a long time ago, and haven't reneged on that back down position since. So, like you say, the phrasing of the European Court is not of crucial importance. Clearly,
yeah, I noticed quite a lot of people have asked why it was that the British government has been required to pay 2,000 euros to her in compensation. Because, of course, she wasn't employed by the British government. This is a thing that a lot of non-lawyers are saying. Just to be clear, that was an award made by the European Court for anxiety. I think it was worded as anxiety, frustration and distress, which is understandable. I mean, you know, you may not agree with this woman's words to the press over the course of the time this case has gone on. But even if you do, so be it. The fact is that it has been an unpleasant experience for her. And, of course, she was disadvantaged for some period of time, at least with her employer. And so it is. And so the British government had an opportunity to put a stop to this this position some time ago, and they didn't choose to do so. And they didn't choose to do so when the case was taken to the European Court, which is why they also had to pay towards her legal costs.
Why did they? How would they have had the opportunity to stop it?
They didn't need to contest the appeal when it went to Europe.
But was it?
That's why it's only such a small amount. That's why it's 2,000 euros and not anything higher. They wouldn't have had an opportunity before that to control.
Sorry, but she was taking the British, but she taking the British, she's not taking British Airways to appeal.
No, it's an action against the state. Yeah,
I suppose it has to be, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of a bizarre way of Article 9 rights.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I thought it was worthy.
I'm not sure how that works. I have to say.
Yeah.
So, Ms. Chaplin, our second applicant.
I think we already know the answer to that one, don't we? We've covered that, I think.
This is our NHS lady. You're quite right. We've covered it. Basically, it's about balancing the aims. And guess what? If your aims are to protect the health and safety of patients on a hospital ward, that is inherently of a greater magnitude than that which applies in respect of the first applicant. So, and I'm using the word of the court there, not just being hyperbolic myself. That is the phrasing that they've used. They cannot conclude that the measures were disproportionate. The interference is necessary, so it's a legitimate aim, but it's totally proportionate. And they've taken into account the measure under Article 14, and similarly, there's no basis upon which they could find a violation. So let's move straight on. Third applicant.
Third and fourth together, I think, really. They'd both signed up to policies that pre-existed, the thing that they then later took exception to.
Well, there's a very interesting point in this as well, though, which is that... you've got employers here who are themselves trying to uphold one of the convention rights in doing their work, especially your Borough of Islington, because they are the state, and they are trying to ensure that they don't breach the convention rights of their potential couples to be married by doing what they're doing. Mm. And what is said by the European Court in this case is that the contracting states enjoy a wide margin of appreciation as to the way in which they achieve that sense of balance. And there's a few different authorities that have been cited there. So, of course, they say that the aim that's being pursued is legitimate. And then as to the question of whether it's proportionate or not, they do deal with this question very thoroughly. They do acknowledge that the requirement was only employed by the employer at a later date. But nevertheless, what they say is you've got this wide margin of appreciation when it comes to striking balances between competing convention rights. And in all the circumstances, given that wide margin that you're given, you've not exceeded your wide margin, and therefore no violation.
Let's just tie this up perhaps this way. The perhaps the most interesting thing about this judgment is, certainly in relation to our British Airways steward, this is, as far as I could figure out, and I think various other people have tried to look into this as well, I think this is actually the first time that the UK has been defeated on an Article 9 point in the European Court.
Oh, that would be news to me. I'd be excited if that was the case.
Well, that seems to be the case, and I certainly stand to be corrected. So the right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion, the UK has got a pretty good record on so far. On this occasion, they lost out.
That's bad, isn't it? Over such an issue as well. Mm. You know, one thinks of it as a very small necklace. That tiny object, that tiny little piece of metal, loses our golden record in the European courts.
Yeah, I read a...
So careful you have to be.
I read an article by Joshua Rosenberg, ex of Law in Action on Radio 4, and he was saying, well, this is interesting, in the past the courts held there's no breach of an employee's religious freedom from, and the example he gave was working on the Sabbath, in which case a worker could find another job, could resign.
This is the point that I was making, because that, of course, goes to the manifestation of the religion and how you can work around it. That doesn't seem to have been challenged here. That's the interesting point.
Well, the court now said that, and he quoted probably the crucial paragraph, I suppose, that the better approach would be to weigh that possibility in the overall balance when considering whether or not the restriction is proportionate.
Yes.
Well, that is now the test, and it should be fairly clear.
Yeah,
in cases where it is, but who knows?
Certainly, it's definitely easier from a legal point of view to concentrate on the question of proportionality than any of the other elements to this.
Mm. All right, well, just before we move on from that to the next article in our little show, it's time to remind you of ways that you can contact us. And this is by magic. I'm going to change the lower third on my screen. We've got the technology now. You can contact us. Oh, you see, they'll know the phone number now because they can see it.
On my screen, but there you go.
All right, well, you can give us a call on 0161 408 5037. I can't do this with a camera, it's very complicated.
0161 408 5037.
Indeed. You can find us on Twitter. We are at NorthPodLaw. And Jonathan, where could they send email if they chose to?
It looks like cheese at Nigel. No, it's mail at northpod.co.uk.
Indeed it is. All right, so and we'd like to hear from you. So, the reason I put the voicemail one there in big letters, if you're watching the video version, is because we just never hear from you. We don't. It's very sad.
Leave prank voicemails. At least that would be
it'd give us a laugh, wouldn't it? Yeah, absolutely. All righty. So what's up next, Kirsten?
This is the case of Robertson and Swift. This is the consumer regulations case, which is a lot more interesting than it sounds if this is not your area of law. And of course, it's extremely interesting if it is your area of law. The court itself actually said that despite the fact that it was a very small matter, it started as a small claim, this, with both sides representing themselves and both sides representing themselves upon appeal, and then one side continuing to represent himself beyond that, actually at the Court of Appeal. But as the court themselves say, it's a really very important legal point, and one that's worth remembering. This is the case then of Mr. Terence John Swift, who owned a firm called A Swift Move. He's a removal man, in effect. It's quite a long established family firm. And on the other side, you've got Dr. Toby Robertson, who, with 5 days to spare, booked Mr. Terence Swift, or one of his vans, to move his house. Mr. Swift had a policy of cancellation fees, depending upon when you cancelled, would make a difference on how much of the original fee you had to pay. And they broke down into between 5 and 10 days, and beyond 10 days, there was no fee at all. And then there's 5 to 10, I think, and less than 5 days, something along those lines. Anyway, he actually booked it with only 5 days to go. As part and parcel of organising a quote, Mr. Swift, or his employee, has to attend at your house to have a look at how much stuff there is to move. Which the court found was perfectly legitimate, and of course is a natural part of moving house. He attended at the address. They discussed the contract, and Mr. Swift then went away. He then sent Dr. Robertson a written quote. I think that's right. He must have done it by a fax machine, because I'm fairly certain it was done on the same day. Or by email, but he sent him a written quote of the fees, and he then went back later on that day in order to discuss various other things. And in the course of that conversation, Dr. Robertson agreed to pay the fee. Right, but the second visit, that isn't really what the second visit was about, from what I remember.
It was to take some boxes for packing his property in.
So the point here is that Dr. Robertson has had the written quote. He's got time to consider it. He's had time, you might think, to phone other companies and find out how much they're charging.
Which he did. Of course.
Well, not at that point. He didn't.
Oh, sorry, no, he did it later. Sorry, no, that's right. He did it a bit later. Sorry, I shall stop.
He agreed the quote, and then sometime later, the following day or a couple of days later, he then telephoned another firm, found that they were cheaper by quite a lot, actually, and therefore telephoned Swift and said, "Yeah, thanks very much. I don't want your services anymore."
Right.
There was a discussion then about how much the cancellation fee would be. Mr. Swift told him that it's usually, because of the time period, it would normally be 60% of the fee. But in this case, he would only charge him 50%. And Dr. Robertson agreed to pay that. He then discovered, I've got rights under the consumer regulations, the
2008.
There are two, actually. You've got the 1987 regulations. This is the consumer protection cancellation of contracts concluded away from business premises. And you've also got they were then replaced in 2008 by the cancellation of contracts made in a consumer's home or place of work, etc. regulations 2008. The original regulations talk about a visit this is excluded where the customer has specifically invited you to their premises.
Yeah.
The 2008 regulations remove that exclusion. So no matter how the parties finish up at your house having a discussion about the contract, the 2008 regulations come into play, which means, in effect, that he has a 7-day cooling off period.
Yeah.
The question that arose before the district judge in the small claims court was the fact that this was a second visit. Did the regulations actually count, because this is a second visit. This isn't a visit, which is the wording. It is multiple visits. And the district judge found, no, it doesn't. That is, it's not a visit, and therefore I'm going to find that he does have to pay the cancellation fee.
Probably with something of a smirk on his face, because the behaviour of our dear little man wishing to move house was not exactly honourable, was it?
It's not great, is it? I mean, I do think, you know, if he'd cancelled it sort of immediately, if he'd done it with 5 days, I think you're probably entitled to then say, well, I'm not paying that big fee, you've not done any work. But in this case, there had been work done. Mr. Swift had had to reorganise an awful lot of things in order to be able to fulfil that contract. And then, of course, it was just cancelled from him.
Yeah.
The cancellation charge was £2,450.60. And there was a counterclaim because Dr. Robertson had also paid £1,000, had already paid £1,000 deposit. So there was a claim against each one. So in the lower court, in the original court, the decision was made in favour of the respondent.
Yeah.
Sorry, no, sorry, in favour of the claimant.
The claimant, yeah.
Because Swift for the cancellation fee. Dr. Robertson then appealed that to a county court job judge, who also found against him for exactly the same reasons, that yes, he would have to pay the cancellation fee. And he appealed again, and the court in this occasion found in his favour, and they did it really very reluctantly. They said in this, particularly in the current climate where you've got a small business, for somebody to be able to suddenly just cancel in this manner, where they've had time to think about it, because it's more than one visit, etc., didn't seem right at all. But they had to say that a visit is, the word is a visit.
Yes.
And clearly a subsequent visit is still a visit. And therefore, on the law, they reluctantly said that he could cancel the contract within 7 days. He has the 7-day cooling off period. And that is the point, really, of the judgment for anybody involved in one of these cases, that 7-day cooling off period applies no matter how you've come to that decision, whatever time has gone on before. If that contract is made within somebody's home, then the 2008 regulations apply. Now, in this case, in addition, there were various other things. The cancellation fees should have been put in writing in order to fulfil the contract, in order to be compliant with the 2008 regulations. Yeah. And that hadn't been done either, again, presumably because it was organised over a period of time. It's a short period of time. What's quite a nice twist in the tale is that obviously the next point that came up was whether the £1,000 deposit, yeah, should be returned. And the court said, nah, you can't have it both ways. If the 2008 regulations apply, he hasn't complied with them, therefore the contract is not voided. Mm. It's just there, and therefore you can't have your deposit back, mate, because it's not been complied with, so you've got no grounds for returning your deposit.
And also, they one of the arguments on behalf of not the removal company, the individual, was that there'd been a failure of consideration in this case, and
that's right.
The court said, well, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Because if the consideration is perfectly clear, the claimant, at your request, Mr. Defendant, has made urgent arrangements and entered into whatever commitments he needs to do to carry out the removal. So there has been a passage of consideration. That was what the deposit was there to cover. So you're not having it back. I find it interesting that not the lead judgment in this case, but one of the just comments by Lord Justice Lewison, who agreed with Lord Justice Jackson. He clearly observed, it's all through gritted teeth. No doubt the judges in the county court were trying to decide the case in accordance with the underlying commercial merits. In other words, yes, they were trying to effectively sort of stop this poor local businessman being ripped off by somebody who thought he'd try it on. But unfortunately, the law allowed him to. So there you go. All a bit grim.
It is grim.
It is for it is.
And a bit funny at the end.
Well, it is. So they that you know the whole being hoisted by his own petard is rather. So rather nice, I have
very,
to
very
say.
Very nice revenge. Story.
Absolutely. Deserved every second of that, I think.
I hope he went out with that £1,000 and had a good time.
I like to imagine so.
Yes, I don't. I think what I doubt it. I suspect what happened was that was probably the costs.
Yes, because in I suspect it was.
For the Court of Appeal case,
yes.
Mr. Swift was still unrepresented.
Oh, no.
Sorry, self-representing.
Yeah, sure.
but the defendant had, the respondent had counsel at the time, and presumably was privately paying for that, I would have thought.
I do like quite how obsequious the Court of Appeal Civil Division is towards these self-representing parties who go and say, well, of course they're self-representing, it's small claims, and that's entirely appropriate. But there's an awful lot of commentary about just how jolly good they all were. But apparently not, because it took the argument of...
Yeah, it's only when he presented that he got a result.
Yeah, well quite.
I have to say, I think, I know we usually like to say that, but I think that was probably coincidence, actually, in this case.
I make that point entirely glibly. Please don't think I'm being serious for a moment there.
I think it's often a valid comment, actually, but I think in this case, both of them were obviously quite articulate and capable of putting forward their...
Right, yeah.
Their case.
All righty. Well, let's now turn to... Now, we have mentioned this some considerable time ago on a previous show, which was the Section 5 of the Public Order Act. So, at the moment, a person is guilty of an offence under that Act. I'm sure you've all heard this recently
if
in
he
Pledgate.
If he swears, it's a policeman.
No, behave yourself. If he uses threatening, abusive, or insulting words or behaviour, you'll have heard those words mentioned a lot on the news on account of that being at the core of Plebgate. Now, let us not divert into the territory of why an awful lot of what's being talked about Plebgate law is nonsense.
You ought to call it non-Plebgate, I think.
Yeah.
Well, who knows right now? Apparently, police officers might occasionally lie, it turns out.
When will this sink in?
I know, but also apparently it may be that government senior civil servants might also be a little economical with the truth as well. I don't know. Who do you believe? A government advisor or a police? I just don't know.
What
anyway,
are you
bygones.
Saying?
I know, it's madness, isn't it? Let's deal with the far more important issue of whether calling somebody's police horse gay is likely to cause problems. And yes, that is one of the, and I'm not making this up, no. That is one of the things that's been considered. Dear old Theresa May, Home Secretary, at time of recording, I'm keeping my fingers crossed, there's still 24 hours, has decided that the House of Lords... consideration of amending the Section 5 of the Public Order Act to remove the word insulting. The House of Lords cannot sensibly be argued against over this. Now, she has told the government very recently, the last couple of days, depending on when you're listening to this, that she's not minded to challenge the amendment. But, because there's always a but, she doesn't agree. She says that she believes that the police should be able to take action when they're sworn at, which means she's a little out of date.
Yeah.
When protesters...
Aura. Thank you.
Absolutely, which I know we've mentioned on the show, I'm sure we'll talk about again in a minute.
They should be able to. Please, that's the point, isn't it? That the police are still going to be able to take...
One of my favourite things to do
on a Friday
night.
Sworn at is actually going to still be covered.
Well, hang on. No, because DPP and Oram is not going to be changed. Let's just pause here for a moment. No, don't get too excited, Jonathan. I can see you're getting excited. She went on to rant that when protesters burn poppies on Armistice Day and things like that, this will prevent the police from doing their job. This is an invaluable tool in helping them keep the peace and maintain public order. Now, the interesting bit was that she says that the DPP, this is the Director of Public Prosecutions, Keir Starmer to you and I, could not, when consulted by her, identify any case where the behaviour leading to a conviction could not be described as abusive as well as insulting.
Well, this is it. Have you ever known a prosecutor bring a case, or when prosecuting, have you ever brought, when you're doing the Section 5s in the mags,
an insult only,
said, this was insulting. I've never ever heard it or done it.
The gay horse thing is actually a real case.
Yeah, it is.
Somebody who was prosecuted. Admittedly, he wasn't actually convicted, was he?
This was an Oxford student who had said to a Thames Valley police officer, "Do you realise your horse is gay?" And he was
may even have been looked gay.
Well, absolutely hilarious.
He was nicked on the basis that that was offensive to people passing by. The other one was the quite famous one was the Scientology placard. 16-year-old holding up a sign saying Scientology is a dangerous cult.
Yep.
Defensive fair comment.
Reasonable.
What? Not I don't know who said that. But yeah, I mean, the question really is, I mean, yeah, I think it's probably fair to say, Jonathan, that the cases where Section 5s are brought on the basis of being insulting only are few and far between.
Yep.
Although, yep. Note Keir Starmer's words, the cases where evidence leading to a conviction...
Yeah, yes. Sure. So in other words, they're all pussy cases that don't get anywhere.
Yeah, so you may well think, listeners, that the real position is that the CPS and the police are just going to be that little bit more careful about the things that they nick people for under Section 5. Mm. But Theresa May must know this, because one of the things that she said about it was that they're a useful... I'm paraphrasing her only very slightly, that Section 5 is a very useful catch-all tool to help keep good order. In other words, we're not really going to figure out what's going on here. We're going to nick you under Section 5.
Yeah. But actually, they do that anyway.
Yeah. Of course they are. They're entitled
to breach of the peace.
Yeah, you just arrest them for fear of breach of the peace. Certainly burning poppies would fall well within that.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Well, it could, at least. So... You know, I think the big situation is here that the House of Lords have said, look, the problem is with the word insulting is that it affects satire, it affects freedom of speech disproportionately to the thing that it's there to protect or that the public order it's designed to protect. Mm. Lots of campaigns about this, Rowan Atkinson, of course, spearheading one of them quite famously.
Yes.
And the answer is the government's back down. Theresa May has done so through more through gritted teeth. But you know what? Suck it up, Theresa, because in reality, it probably won't make much of a difference in terms of convictions.
You know, that should be the title for this week's episode. Gritted
suck
teeth.
It up, Theresa.
We said that, didn't we? Yes, we said it's through gritted teeth. Yeah.
I want this episode to be called Suck It Up, Theresa. Go on, let me.
No.
Oh,
well, I feel a little bit cheated now, I must admit. But anyway, I mean, is there a story here, really?
No, because it isn't going to make any difference, because one of the things that they're not doing, they're not taking out the insulting side of it, if there is an identifiable victim, which we were talking about before we went on air, has to mean, unless they're going to put new legislation in place, has to mean that what they're saying is if you insult somebody
or a horse
specific, then that is an offence. Now, if you're going
I'm not sure that's exactly what's being said about it, because I think what they're saying is that in circumstances where there's insulting behaviour where it's used directly to someone, in other words, where there is an identifiable
they must
victim,
be saying that constitutes abuse.
That becomes abuse rather than insulting behaviour. Now, I mean, it's a matter of semantics,
sure.
Really.
It is, but I'm not sure it helps Rowan Atkinson to a large degree. So, yes, it means you can make sort of sweeping statements, but you couldn't specifically go, you know, if you went to a political rally, for example, and said something that was insulting to a politician, is that really abusive, or is that not just expressing your view possibly in a satirical manner?
Well, maybe. I mean, I do quite like some of the responses. I mean, the National Secular Society's response congratulating Theresa May, which I'm fairly sure they don't do that often, says, well, this is very good.
Well,
they said this is very good because this means that street evangelists are now going to be free to preach against homosexuality in the streets, which is true. And yay them for their freedom of speech.
I don't know.
Well, indeed.
It may
indeed.
Well constitute abuse, then. You may find that that's abusive.
It depends if they're abusive directly to someone, I suppose, yes. But I think in reality what this means is that somebody's insulting words or behaviour generally are no longer going to be the sort of thing that wastes court time and waste that's police time. And Theresa May's objection is, well, yes, but how will police ever cope with doing their job if they can't nick for fairly spurious reasons and then sort it out later? Well, the answer is quite simply, if there's absolutely, yeah, if you need to arrest somebody for to prevent a breach of the peace, then crack on and do it.
Yes.
But otherwise, don't faff about. I paraphrase slightly, perhaps the point of that. But I think that's probably about what we've got time for. I think we're up to an hour.
It is the only other matter I want to mention very briefly is anybody who's dealing with a murder case where you're looking at the tariff on a mandatory life sentence, you might want to have a look at the case of Griffiths and others.
Yes.
It's a Court of Appeal Criminal Division case. I'm not going to go into what it's all about, but it's a case that if you're dealing with one of those, have a look at it. It sets down some guidance on what the sensible tariffs are for a variety of murder cases.
Yeah, we'll try and put that in the show notes, actually. There you go. I've got my show title at the bottom of the screen now, which I'm sure you'll all love. There you go. Suck it up, Teresa. Just a reminder of those contact details again. I've put the phone number in international format there because looking at our listener figures, quite a lot of people in the States listen to us. Can I just
point out that this is abusive and there's an identifiable victim?
I'm not being abusive. I'm just telling her to suck it up.
You might be being insulting, and it's an identifiable victim.
Well, I'll leave it to her to send the boys around. All right, so you can contact us on 0044 or +44 if you're outside of the UK, 161-408-5037. You can find us on Twitter. We're at NorthPodLaw. And you can email us. We are mail@northpod.co.uk. Sorry for those watching the video that there's no theme tune at the start or end of the show. But for those listening on the podcast, here it is. And thank you very much for your kind assistance, Mr. Holt. And lovely to see you again, Ms. Bezic. We shall reconvene via video some other day.
Marvellous.